I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. In 2012, Lawrence Lanahan led a team here at WIPR that explored racial inequity in the Baltimore region in a year-long radio and multimedia series called The Lines Between Us. Lanahan has just published a book in which he continues his examination of the effects of racial bias in housing, education, and economic opportunity by chronicling the journeys of an African-American family who moves from the city to Howard County and a white family who moves from the suburbs to West Baltimore. It's called The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest to Cross Baltimore's Racial Divide. Lawrence Lanahan joins me along with Mark Carter, the executive director of the Neusong Community Learning Center in Sandtown, Winchester. Plus, J. Wynn Russick reviews the Queen's Girl plays at the Everyman Theater. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for hanging with us today. In 2012, Lawrence Lanahan was the senior producer on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast here on WIPR. As you know, Sheila now hosts On the Record weekday mornings here on 88.1. I was part of the team on that show as well when Lawrence had the idea to do a weekly series of programs called The Lines Between Us, a multimedia exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. Every Friday for a year, we did stories about how racial inequity affects the people of our region, the economy, the places we live, and the access to opportunity that some of us enjoy much more easily than others. In 2014, the series was awarded an Alfred I. DuPont Columbia Award, one of the highest honors in journalism. Lawrence has used some of the research he developed at that time and a lot of new reporting about what's happened in our area in the ensuing years to produce a book called The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest to Cross Baltimore's Racial Divide. In this literary iteration of Lines, he chronicles the journeys of two families, one who leaves their West Baltimore home and moves to Howard County, and another who leaves the suburbs to move into Sandtown, Winchester, the West Baltimore neighborhood that was ground zero of the violence and uprising that followed Freddie Gray's death while in police custody back in 2015. A little later in the show, we'll be joined by Mark Carter. He's the executive director of one of Sandtown's most impactful organizations, the Neusong Community Learning Center. But now, Lawrence Lanahan joins me in Studio A to tell us more about the new book. We won't take your calls right away. We'll take them a little bit later, but you're welcome to drop us a tweet or catch us on the WIPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. Welcome back, sir. Good to see you.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's great to be back here.
So let's get folks up to speed, and if they hadn't heard it or if they'd had forgotten about it, what were your aspirations back in 2012, 2013 for the radio series of The Lines Between Us, and then how have those aspirations evolved for this book?
Sure. I mean, you just you live in Baltimore long enough and you realize there's two Baltimores, and when I came to produce here in 2009, you know, story after story, that was the backstory, was inequality. And I just started thinking through it, you know, I was putting it in those notions into what I was producing. But I just felt like, what if we took the backstory and made it the story? Because we have this kind of polite way of talking about it around here. And I thought, you know, hey, public radio, anybody can listen. It can be this hub where we can all try to have that conversation. So that was kind of the inspiration for the series. Like, what if every Friday we talked about this? What would we get somewhere? And we did 50 episodes, as you remember. And then there was still so much to talk about. I wanted to do a couple weeks on health, a couple weeks on the arts. Didn't even get to that. So I started freelance reporting. You know, after the series ended, I left WIPR. Ended up doing a lot of housing reporting, and I did a story about housing mobility. This notion that the white suburbs, the more prosperous suburbs, have always resisted low-income housing. And there had been a lot of fair housing advocates and attorneys who had been trying to crack open opportunities out in the suburbs, meeting a lot of resistance. And so I wrote about some tools that HUD was producing, like some maps and stuff like that, to help facilitate some moves for, you know, poor residents of the city, public housing residents out in the counties, you know.
And of course, these are often called moving to opportunity.
Moving to opportunity. There's the Baltimore, there's newer programs. So I kind of told the story of one family in particular that had moved from West Baltimore out to Columbia. I ended up doing this. That was for Al Jazeera America. And then I did another story for them. about Christian community development, this notion that if you want to help a poor black neighborhood, that you're not going to go in and out from 9 to 5 and understand the felt needs of that community, that they say you should move in. If you want to help a community, you should have something at stake and be living there. And I was kind of fascinated by that. So I told the story of some people who were doing that. Then I kind of realized I had these two stories of people crossing the lines between us, right? Moving, a white family moving from Bel Air out in Harford County, you know, mostly white, pretty prosperous community, into Sandtown, which is almost entirely black and poor. And then the other family that moved from Penn North, which is adjacent to Sandtown, out to Columbia. It's like, if you want to see the lines between us, see how epic it is just for somebody to cross it. And I also realized that by telling those two stories, you would get the story of Christian community development. You get the story of James Rouse and Kurt Schmoke pouring money into Sandtown in the 90s to revitalize it. You get the story of Thompson v. HUD, this federal public housing desegregation lawsuit. We'll get into that later, but that was a hugely important suit.
That was in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm. It eventually created a lot of special housing choice vouchers that you can only use in what they call communities of opportunity, you know, like certain, you know, less poverty, more jobs. At one point, even like, you know, whiter, you know, facilitating desegregation. So if you know, with the series, if I had kind of had a more inchoate notion of like, gosh, there's these two worlds, why can't we figure out what keeps them apart, you know, 5-6 years later, I had a few stories, and I know I could talk about some really important developments that could help explain it.
Introduce us a little bit to the two families that you profile. One, the woman who moved with her son from Penn North out to Howard County, a woman named Nicole Smith. What's her story?
Well, she was living in Penn North. She grew up in West Baltimore. And she had spent a little bit of time with her family in Murphy Homes, which is a high-rise public housing project. And she eventually got one of these vouchers that came out of the Thompson suit that you could use out in the counties. And she moved her son out from Penn North out to Columbia and, you know, enrolled in community college and started her own home daycare. Got her son into some, high performing schools in Howard County. And, she's one story. She's the one that kind of crosses the lines going out. And,
The lines going in, a family named Mark, or a guy named Mark Lang and his family.
Mark and Betty, they, were living out in Bel Air, and, they had, some friends, Alan and Susan Tibbles, who in the 80s, believed in this Christian community development and moved from Howard County into Sandtown. And Mark and Betty kind of supported what they were doing, but they also were living the American dream. Mark started his own company, you know, they got a nice house out in Bel Air. Like, it's like 2 miles from where I grew up, you know, I know where they're, you know, living. And, you know, they were all set up, you know, but they both had this sort of tension gnawing at them, especially Mark at first, you know, of just like, he was working in the city, he was getting to know black people in the city, he was working in neighborhoods that were disinvested, and he'd go back to Bel Air, and there's just this tension gnawing at him. He's like, why was I born white? Why do I live here? What are my obligations? And he's deeply religious, you know, so it's got this tint of, you know, what is this truth that I'm getting out of the scripture dictate as far as what I'm supposed to be doing in my time and place. It's Betty who finally says, you know, we got to move to Sandtown. She's reading Dr. John Perkins, who kind of came up with this Christian community development notion. He was a civil rights veteran from Mississippi. And it was his idea, like, you know, you got to move in. You got to feel the needs that everybody else is feeling. I had reported on a little bit on Nicole and Mark before, and I didn't want to get caught up in getting the perfectly representative white and black people from these separate worlds, right? it's not going to happen. I just went with some people I had reported on, whose stories I knew the basic contours of. Boy, there was a lot more to it, of course, with any life there's going to be. And so I followed the Langs in, and I followed Nicole and her son out.
Lawrence Lanahan, the book is called The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest Across Baltimore's Racial Divide. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. You write, and we talked about this a lot in the series back in 2012 and 13, that inequity when it comes to housing, when it comes to education, when it comes to job opportunities, et cetera, it didn't just happen. It wasn't this, serendipitous thing that just sort of occurred. It was designed. In what ways?
Well, read Antero's book. Not My Neighbor by Antero Piazzolla.
Which is about redlining.
Redlining and blockbusting and restrictive covenants and segregation ordinances. He writes a great book about how the landscape of inequality in this region came to be. So it was really, the black spaces and white spaces, the rich spaces and poor spaces were if not explicitly designed, they were certainly facilitated by white people in power. So what I was trying to do was kind of like, well, why is it still that way?
Because redlining was officially, outlawed, at least on the books, some time ago. Right?
Yeah. Kennedy signed an executive order in 1960 saying, no discrimination in federal housing.
Yeah.
But the FHA had already basically financed the suburbs and done it for white people, We had a guy in the series who was a black World War II veteran, right? And he got the GI Bill. He had, nowhere to buy, so he bought in Mondawmin. And look what happened there in 2015.
Yeah. Interesting. You write that when Baltimore County, for example, began its or peaked in its suburbanization, and when we talk about white flight, from the city in the 50s and 60s, it got huge. It grew by 76% from 270,000 people to about 450,000 people in the 10 years between 1950 and 60. And it also got a whole lot whiter.
The black population dropped. You had 200,000 new white people in Baltimore County. The black population dropped. And I picked a graph out of a government report that shows that. It's stunning. I defy anyone to tell me that just happened, right? They were zoning these little black communities out of the county. So that graph tells you everything you need to know, that this did not just happen.
And the Thompson v. Hud case in 1995 drew on this kind of deliberate discrimination, this deliberate segregation of poor black communities in certain places and more prosperous white communities in other places. Give us the background of that case and then how it turned out.
Sure. So, when public housing was built in Baltimore, it was segregated by law. It was placed in the black project were placed in communities that were already black. There was one Gilmore Homes they were going to build in Southwest Baltimore, and then people said, "No, that's going to be dangerous for white people walking to school and work." I mean, that's the quote. So they put it in Sandtown under the notion of slum clearance. But I have pictures in the book of some of these houses they knocked down. They're perfectly fine houses. They kind of created these the landscape of public housing. And in the 90s, the city, there was the people were saying like, oh, maybe we shouldn't have high-rise public housing. It's not good for anybody. And there's pressure from the federal government to redo public housing as mixed income and tear these towers down. When that talk started, some fair housing advocates in the city started getting together and organizing some of them were saying you're letting these things rot. It's a foregone conclusion. They're going to knock them down and we need these units. Other people were like, if you're going to knock them down, you better not replace them here. You segregated this in the 40s. Don't do it again in the 90s, you need to make opportunities all over the counties. And so it came up to a lawsuit. The ACLU of Maryland helped a few public housing residents file a complaint against the city and the city's housing authority and against HUD, and saying that they had a duty to disestablish the segregation, that there was some active discrimination, they had failed to affirmatively further fair housing. They had quite a few counts there. And so the eventually there was a partial settlement in 1996. Like, all right, we're going to renovate a few houses in the city and, you know, mostly white, more prosperous neighborhoods. We're going to make 1300 and some, housing vouchers available that are only to be used in, majority white, you know, low poverty communities. And it's this, a big groundswell of support for opportunities arising for people to move out of public housing into what they call communities of opportunity, like where the opportunity already is.
And they move there not without some pretty significant resistance from some of the people in the neighborhoods in which they were trying to move.
Sure. And what you see throughout the course of this whole century in the book and Antra's book and lots of other books is white communities sort of taking their personal preferences or prejudices, whatever you want to call them, and sort of using public policy and law to institutionalize them, right? You had the segregation ordinance, the Supreme Court flipped that. Then you got restrictive covenants, you know, then the Supreme Court flipped that. And you just keep seeing, you know, before it was more overt and now it's more covert. You might hear people say, you know, and this may be legitimate, you know, we don't want the roads to be overcrowded, we don't want the schools, but you'll eventually hear somebody say, like, we don't want them. You know, or they'll just tag it to Section 8 and say, Section 8 people, you know, there's going to be burglars, this and that. So, yeah, in the 90s, HUD tried to move, like, I think 280 or so families out to communities with less than 10% poverty, and you had some vicious resistance.
And I want to talk about that when we come back from a break. My guest is Lawrence Lanahan. The book is called The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest to Cross Baltimore's Racial Divide. We'll have more with Lawrence Lanahan after a break, and we'll be joined by the executive director of the New Song Community Learning Center, Mark Carter. You are welcome to join us, too, when we come back, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at midday WYPR, and you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a conversation with Stephen Brill, the journalist, lawyer, and entrepreneur who's the author of a very compelling book about the challenges America faces and the people who are working to address those challenges. It's called Tailspin, The People and Forces Behind America's 50-Year Fall and Those Fighting to Reverse It. Stephen Brill joins me for the hour tomorrow on Midday. Coming up later today, our theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review a couple of one-woman shows at Baltimore's Everyman Theater. We'll hear about the Queens Girls series in just a bit. But now, back to our conversation with Lawrence Lanahan, the author of the new book, The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest to Cross Baltimore's Racial Divide. In the book, Lawrence chronicles the journeys of Mark Lang and Nicole Smith. Mark, a white suburbanite, moves into Sandtown, Winchester, while Nicole moves herself and her son away from Baltimore City into Howard County. Our next guest goes to work every day in Sandtown, Winchester. He lives not far away in Reservoir Hill. Mark Carter is the executive director of the New Song Community Learning Center. Again, we are streaming our conversation on the Facebook page at WYPR. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr, and our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. Mark Carter, welcome. Good to see you, sir.
Good to see you, brother. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. So the challenges of the neighborhood, the challenges that the family that Lawrence profiles in his book, Mark and Betty Lang, people talk about, you know, the need for investment in a place like Sandtown, Winchester. In your view, what should investment look like?
Well, I think there are a few things to start off with. New Song is a very rich community. And when I say that, I mean that it has an amazing assemblage of resources and supports from families and from community leaders. And one of the things that I happen to be the beneficiary of is New Song Community Learning Center and Academy. It's not a singular leadership that I provide to that institution. There's a brilliant principal. Her name is Lisa Brown. She and I are co-partners in what takes place there. When you think about investment in community, it really is about schools. And I think what I want your listeners to know as we go forward in this discussion today are the following words: race, class, privilege, intergenerational deprivation and trauma, and one possible remedy is a healing-centered organization, school, and love. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the investment is it's not just about monetary dollars coming into the community. It's what do people understand to be the issues? How are people committed to talking about those issues honestly and candidly? And then what's the work in order to move them mm-hmm. along? And New Song is tens of thousands of square feet of a gleaming school where we have 166 children, incredible families who love their children madly and dearly and monumentally. I think it's also important for people to know that Sandtown Winchester is not just total calamity and violence. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's obviously violence. Drug use in the neighborhood. There's drug dealing in the neighborhood. But it is a neighborhood that is extraordinary for a variety of reasons. The things that our children demonstrate in terms of grit and a willful determination, as well as our parents. So I think there is, at the same time, an investment to be made from key entities in the city that lead public education, public safety, public health. Those things have been not present in Sandtown Winchester, but let's also be frank about it. They're not present in many other neighborhoods. I mean, we're talking mm-hmm. about Sandtown Winchester, but I also want to say that this is not unique in Baltimore.
Sure. And Lawrence, the work that Mark and Betty Lang did once they moved into Sandtown Winchester, talk about what their involvement in the community meant.
Well, I think what they followed with the kind of their Christian community development imperative was, which was to kind of get there and be there with, right? And listen and figure it out and not come in with plans and not come in to dominate the conversation. So they kind of got to know their neighbors. They did some stuff, you know, helping out. Somebody started a business in Sandtown, and they called on Mark to do a little bit of work on the building. You know, Mark helped give one of his neighbors driving lessons. You know, Betty was mentoring a couple of girls. But, you know, as far as doing the work, you know, they and a lot of people who do things this way are very self-conscious about being some kind of white savior, right? And so a lot of times what they talk about when doing the work is love. I mean, like, I'm glad you brought that up because, I mean, I don't know if somebody's going to find it corny coming out of my book, but love is an investment. And, you know, if you are trying to love from afar, as I was actually once accused of doing in my writing, loving the city from afar, you know, that's an issue. And so they thought by being there, by letting the resources that follow them to Sandtown, that they might be of some help. But for them, that's a very, very spiritual thing. And relationships are the big investment, you know, as far as
Tom,
this.
If I could add something to that, I think that there's a whole show waiting to be done, and hopefully you will do it, of what it means to be white and to come into a black neighborhood, and what it means to black and to be there already, and to want the same things for your children that someone who is white comes in when they come into the neighborhood. And I think part of, listen, I enjoy this amazing school because of Alan and Susan Tibbles, and no doubt about that. There are...
Who, I will remind folks, were the inspiration for Mark and Betty Lang to move into Sandtown Winchester.
Exactly. And since Susan's departure around 2010, 2011, there have been some amazing black people who have undertaken the mantle of responsibility at New Song and advanced it. And part of what the board asked me to do in coming in was to help to think through changes and transitions that would position the school for other development. Part of that, I think, is... an interesting moment that I had when I first arrived in Baltimore. I said some things which seemed perfectly reasonable to me at that time about the racism in the city and what was going on in public education and public health and public safety. And someone said to me, you know, Baltimore is the South. And I didn't really understand that, right? And I said, well, it's between Baltimore, it's between Washington and Philadelphia. It's, you know, cosmopolitan city. They're like, no, it's the South. And there are ways in which you as a black man need to comport yourself. You need to be thoughtful about your tone, about the way in which you present issues, how assertively and how aggressively you present those issues. I think part of what's really unique about New Song, both the, as my partner in greatness, and we are in the midst of engineering and educational uprising, that'd be Lisa Brown, is that there are people who have always been at New Song. We are liberating their voice, right? And giving them, not in a paternalistic way, but opening up opportunities for them. We have young people who graduated from the program who are now working in the program as tutors and as assistants to, in one instance, the director who's leading the whole child initiative where we do restorative practices and a host of other things. So I think, again, I want to say to the listeners, there are a lot of brilliant black people in Baltimore City, Sandtown, and across the town, whatever neighborhood they're on, right? And then I think that part of the educational uprising, too, is exploring the history of the city. Lawrence referenced the book Not in My Neighborhood, but I think there's some other vestiges of institutional racism in public education. I think it's Brown in Education, and that's the name of the book. Black Social Capitalism in Urban School Reform, another book that's really pretty interesting.
Sure.
So, yeah, I think that there are some other issues at play that don't always get attention that, you know, is it totally between
the lines.
And of
course, there's two parts to this story, Lawrence. And one is, you know, building up and elevating the neighborhoods that are impoverished. And the other is, you know, individuals moving, literally the program used to be called Moving to Opportunity. I mean, Barbara Samuels, the lawyer for the ACLU, who you talk a lot about in the book, she was involved in the Thompson versus HUD case, tells me that there are now some, she just wrote me an email this morning, there are about 4,400 families that have moved to housing in better neighborhoods.
Yeah, I just saw some data in a report that shows Baltimore is more in balance compared to most metropolitan regions about where low-income families of color are choosing to rent. I mean, you can now see it because of the work that Barbara and so many people have done.
Because in addition to white flight in Baltimore, there was black flight to Baltimore out of Baltimore. I mean, there's a black middle class that no longer lives here that decided for a variety of reasons, schools, et cetera, to, you know, move to Owings Mills, to move to Randallstown, to move to places outside of the city.
Right. And you know, Barbara really makes the point. Like, some people put this notion of place-based investment, you know, and housing mobility as this either or, like you help out in the neighborhood or you get people out of the neighborhood, you know, and it's not an either or, you know, it's a both and. And so, especially the Fair Housing Act compels, you know, people like Barbara and others to crack open the white suburbs. You know, black families might choose not to go there. You know, they might choose to, you know, invest in their communities where they are, but they have to have that opportunity under the Fair Housing Act, you know? So there's a lot in the book that that's going on, but, you know, I wanted to say something about, you know, black leadership in black communities. You know, you'll see in the book a lot of people in Sandtown and other neighborhoods saying, listen, you know, like, we have leaders. We are leaders. We are raising the next generation of leaders, and they're growing up and they're staying here and they will continue to lead. And, you know, please listen to what we're saying, especially after the uprising. You know, Sandtown became this stage and this symbol, and people are like, we're living here. We can't get to the pharmacy now. We can't get past the cops to get home. If, you know, come find the leaders who are here. And that's the thing with Christian community development that you're supposed to do is like you know, the rule with New Song's Christian community development that Antoine Bennett helped to lead was, if you're white and you're starting a program in the neighborhood, you have to at least have a co-leader who lives there.
Absolutely.
Right. I think the other thing to note as well is that no one who's listening to this broadcast or that we talk with in our different social and political circles should have been surprised by the uprising. It was the manifestation of either willful blindness, people who could see the obvious but chose not to speak truth to power, and it's a transformative moment for the city. And yet on the other side of it, I think part of what we endeavor to do at New Song is to seize upon that opportunity. Yeah, it's one of the reasons we reference part of what we're doing as the educational uprising. But to seize upon that opportunity with all of our faculty, there are 16 amazing teachers There are paraprofessionals there who work with our children. And every single day, we want to talk not only about academic and educational objectives that put our students on a par with any other school in Baltimore City, but also about racial justice, about equity, mm-hmm. about inclusion. And we're not going to back off of those things. New Song is in the midst of applying for a charter. Part of what we have said in no uncertain terms is that this is our mission. This is our commitment.
Applying to become a charter school. Let me share an email from Blake who says, Baltimore was marketed for years as a city of neighborhoods, the Italian, African-American, Lithuanian, Polish, et cetera. Every summer there were and are events celebrating unique cultural heritage. How does the sociological celebration figure into the interesting discussion today? So, Mark, I mean, this New Song is kind of a manifestation of a celebration of African-American history and culture.
Absolutely.
As well as, you know, the potential for achievement. And what happens, and Lawrence, you write about the uprising. When we talk about the NIMBY problem, N-I-M-B-Y, not in my backyard, where people, and you write about instances in Anne Arundel County and Baltimore County where there's a lot of resistance to black families moving in, they use the uprising, for better or for worse, as an example of what could happen in their, you know, currently peaceful neighborhoods if, you know, people of African lineage come and live there. This problem isn't going away. That rhetoric, if anything, has been ramped up in the current national administration.
And that's that clearly is a falsehood of epic proportions. And I totally understand why we are in the space that we are in politically and socially with the person who occupies the White House and all the rhetoric that follows. I think what your listeners might also wrap their heads around is that there are incredible complexities washing over not just the children of Sandtown Winchester, but the children all over this city and other major metropolitan urban areas. I opened up by saying there were some things that I wanted people to grapple with, which, you know, has to do with trauma and intergenerational trauma. Here's what's remarkable, and this is part of what should be celebrated. Again, part of my moniker is that all children are geniuses until proven otherwise. They're amazing at how they resolve the things that they see on a daily basis in their families and the streets.
I want to go to the phones to Mitchell in Northeast Baltimore. Mitchell, welcome to Midday.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Excellent conversation. I actually just had a conversation with a coworker about some injustice, and he's a person that comes from another country, and he said African Americans didn't take advantage of the opportunities. And we kind of got into it, so they don't understand, but part about the move to opportunity, I worked at a company called Vulcan Heart on North Point Road, and I'll never forget, I believe it was around 95, 96 when all that, or 97 when that was going on, and I remember when they talked about it, and the guys on the job, which was mostly Caucasian, they're going to come and mess up the neighborhoods, and I'd be daggone, all the houses around the job, they had Century 21, all of the realtors, all there, they had the front, you know, the signs out in front of the houses when they announced that move to opportunity on the news.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. Same thing happened when there was a consent decree for hiring at Bethlehem Steel about, 20 years before that.
So is Lawrence, I mean, as we wrap up here, is the answer or is part of the answer mixing all of the neighborhoods that we have all around the city? I mean, mixing African-American and white families and completely integrating neighborhoods, or is it deal with that in terms of the tension of historically black neighborhoods that want to remain historically black?
I think the answer is to listen to black people and black communities. I mean, I'm not going to go into a black neighborhood and be like, hey, maybe if you guys moved out to White Marsh, things would balance out. I think that I think the onus is on white people. I think the onus is on copping to the inequality in the region. And I think if you're white and you read the book, like, there's not like generic white people in this book, right? You know, like sometimes in journalism, there's like people and then there's black people and the black communities and the things that are happening in the black communities. Like everybody in this book that's white is white in a certain way and kind of described as such. And so I think if you're white and you read this book, you'll answer that for yourself. Ask yourself, who do you love and where and who's your neighbor and what are my obligations in a region that was programmed for decades for my benefit?
Yeah, and Mark, I mean, the difference between a life expectancy for a kid born in Harlem Park and a kid born in Roland Park is 20 years. It's been that way for decades.
Yes.
I mean, what is, in your view, the best way to tackle that?
Well, I think one way is to have honest conversations, such as the one we're having on your show today. Another is to have honest conversations outside of the studio in the hallowed halls of Baltimore City Public Schools, North Avenue. The police station, police headquarters. I think here's what I learned 20 years ago when I said some things in a meeting, and I understand why it was difficult. I talked about deconstructing racism. And just last evening, I was with a board member. We were with a really brilliant person who's come in from California. She's in a meeting in D.C. She talked about decolonizing. I think that's what we have to really also figure out. How do we decolonize people's thinking? That's not just white folks, that's black folks. And how do we engineer something like a New Song Academy, not just in Sandtown, but in every other community across the city? A small school, intimate school, loves children, black and white children, loves the teachers, and is healing-centered work. That's what I think we have to do.
And healing-centered not just for the children, but also in many instances for their parents.
For their parents.
For their community.
Yeah. Well, for their parents and for the staff. Yeah. I mean, you got to heal the healers. If you're not healing the healers, the rest of it will fall apart too.
Mark Carter is the executive director of the New Song Community Learning Center in Sandtown. Winchester Lawrence Lanahan is the author of The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest Across Baltimore's Racial Divide. Lawrence will be talking about his new book at Red Emma's, that's across the street from the Meyerhoff Symphony Hall in Baltimore, next Wednesday, May 29th. Starts at 7 o'clock. We'll have details on our website at wipr.org/midday. Lawrence, congratulations on the book. Good luck with it. Mark, congratulations on New Song, and good luck as you continue your
Thanks
really
for having
work.
Me, brother. And love you. Tom. Love everybody else. Yeah. Okay.
Coming up after a short break, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick joins me with her review of not one, but two new plays at Baltimore's Everyman Theater. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.